Hello and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit and Collective podcast. Throughout the series, we will broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews we've conducted in the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions in the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we are oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we are @NCL_oralhistory. Wendy Rickard has worked as a freelancer as well as an academic oral historian, credited as the key interviewer for Nick Park's Creature Comforts, the stop-motion animated series with a cast of animals, soundbiting on specific topics each episode. The show satirises documentary interviews and uses Wendy's street-style vox pops. And like some other oral historians, her relationship with universities has been intermittent and at times ambivalent. Yet she remains one of the most significant, if too often unheard, voices of oral history, and she is one of the most reflective of our practitioners, with an incisive understanding of the changing narratives that we live by. When working for universities, Wendy has been employed in health, social care and medical schools, and has an extensive experience of conducting oral histories with underrepresented groups that include sex workers, bereaved carers, families who have been labelled as troubled, and HIV survivors. In addition, she has lectured on radical health promotion, public health, and oral history. Every so often, Wendy drops off the grid. She has other interests outside the disciplines of oral history. So every so many years, Wendy and I catch up. Nowadays, she's located on a farmstead with her family, worrying about how to keep a small rural business going. Given her record of working with people at times of crisis, it felt like a good time to reconnect, so I gave her a call. In our following discussion, Wendy covers a range of issues that she's returned to in her work: risky interviewing, working with interviewees, co-production, and power in research. Unsurprisingly, given her past professional attachment to public health, she has also become interested in oral history studies of past epidemics. I began our catch-up by asking her about one of my favourite oral history articles. Written by Wendy, it's called Oral History: More Dangerous Than Therapy, Interviewees' Reflections on Recording Traumatic or Taboo Issues. Originally published in Oral History in 1998, it was republished for a special edition celebrating the journal's 50th birthday in 2019. Wendy, in her article, describes meeting a group of interviewees, including HIV survivors, at the British Library to hear and discuss their archive recordings. Some are, you know, this is some years after the original interviews. The article has also recently been referenced in the British Library's COVID-19 Oral History Guidelines. I began by asking what she thought of that.
I think it's the first time they've ever really mentioned and acknowledged it, so that was sort of interesting. I think it's good. The guidelines, yeah, I've had a look at them. I think there's a real reluctance around the whole thing about interview, you know, sort of take risky interviewing, interviewing people that are dying, putting off interviewing if it doesn't feel safe. And I feel like, you know, back in the time when I wrote More Dangerous Than Therapy, we were taking more risks than you're allowed to take these days. And some of those are very sensible around safeguarding and ethical issues. But some of those really kind of rule out some of that quite earthy, gutsy, you know, be driven by your intuition kind of oral history, which I really, really like. So yeah, it's quite interesting to think back about it and think what's different now. I think the reason that that piece was quite nice for me was that there was something a little bit kind of subversive and delicate about it. And I think people still want that, don't they? And a lot of that goes out when you start getting more oral history and big models being rolled out, and you don't get so many sort of people out on the edges doing slightly edgy stuff, probably quite dangerously.
I also wanted to know more about Wendy's approach to co-production and oral history, as well as her reading of oral histories of earlier epidemics in relation to COVID-19.
that whole thing about co-creation, about developing some kind of social critique with the people who are involved in it, I think is still powerful.
Which is the idea, it's part of the democratisation of oral history, to involve people at the analytical stage as well as the collection stage.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of that is because actually it's a really dangerous thing to do. And really that piece was about, you know, you're really putting yourself on the line, aren't you? Because you could get absolutely slated and that doesn't feel very nice. It was a bit of an ouch situation. And in some ways that piece was about people doing that. But in some ways that was really good to kind of mine that and dig that up, because it's there for everybody. Whatever situation you're interviewing in, there are those levels of, you know, ooh, you know, issues about boundaries with the people that you're interviewing, issues about privilege and about who you interview, whose voice gets heard. You know, all of those things are still incredibly relevant and difficult to find, difficult to explore properly.
I sometimes think that researchers, particularly academics, have got fairly fragile egos. You know, so if you step into a situation like that, I think you can feel exposed. Can you remember your feelings when you did that, when you went to the British Library with that group?
Yes, I felt very exposed and slightly scared of what they were going to say. And they were really forthright, and they were very intellectually savvy as well. I mean, really, really interesting how sharp things became. And the emotional stuff, because some of them had recorded around a time when they were imminently going to die. And then by the time we recorded that discussion, they weren't so imminently going to die, but they could, you know. So it was, and you say different things, you kind of parcel your narrative differently, I think, in relation to that, especially in the way you describe other members of your family and in the way that you perhaps interact with people like oral historians. There were some nice things about it, because I think people sort of generally find oral historians fairly unthreatening in comparison to other professional groups. So particularly for lots of the people that I come into contact with, you know, people in health and social care, although they can be brilliant, they can also be very, I don't know, there's a risk of being very patronising, of being slightly, you know, different, of putting themselves in a different position. And, you know, I liked all the things that they said about kind of getting into the closet with the interviewee. It brought up for me lots of things about potentially being a bit of a fraud, and that thing about being a bit of a chameleon when you're an oral historian and you're kind of being everything that your interviewees want you to be. But some part of, you know, I was aware at the same time, you know, I was interviewing people sometimes in very difficult circumstances, and I had an academic job. I had a salaried post. I wasn't in those circumstances, and I certainly wasn't facing death in that way, which is absolutely fine. But it's also, you know, there's a fault line there that you're running along, isn't there? That about how the extent to which people identify with where you're coming from. I think it's true of when you look to other professions, sort of thinking of the stuff that I do around public health, it's the same thing. You know, there really isn't very much, you know, some of the more interesting involvement stuff around the edges is starting to challenge that. But the really good stuff isn't coming out of professional departments, is it? It's coming out of community development, individuals on the outskirts doing really good co-production stuff.
I know you've been looking at other literature around Ebola and SARS. Is there anything there that's worth pointing out to people?
I think there's some really interesting stuff about what you might record in these times. And I think there's some interesting reading about how rumours and stories, basically, in countries where Ebola has been rife, the rumours and stories about it have spread faster than the actual virus has. And it's been really important to capture all of that. And the idea that you can capture by recording actually through an epidemic, you can capture all the things that didn't work, all the kind of ethically dubious decisions that were made, all the things that in terms of policymakers and social justice are kind of brushed under the carpet later on. And we kind of forget that they happened, you know, to be interviewing people in the heat of the moment, you capture all of that. And the people that went through some really peculiar things that were stimulated by policies that were meant well but really went wrong. So capturing all of that stuff, I think that's been interesting from that literature. I think the thing about the problems of people's narrative changing over time, so if you're interviewing people over successive occasions, then there's, you know, there's some trembling between fiction and memory, and things not staying the same, things that border on being a bit libelous, you know, walking that tightrope that oral historians always walk. But I think in those situations, it probably becomes even more marked and hence more important to record, but also difficult to deal with. I think there's some stuff that I've read also about, really interesting stuff about recording what people's nightmares are around it, which is difficult to ask people about, but really, really interesting in terms of how you interpret that with what's really going on. And then about how people get any sense of hope, because it's varied and interesting, and people really do think philosophically at deep levels about these things and have some lovely and amazing ways of finding things hopeful. And I think some of those Ebola projects really captured that in a beautiful way. And the idea that, I suppose, around viruses and the spread of pathogens, you know, we really do get put into a sort of very medical world about sort of thermometers, about diagnostic tools and medical testing. And, you know, really narrative is another kind of diagnostic instrument that tells you about what's going on, and a really important one. So, yeah, that kind of stuff. And I suppose also reminding us not to be so outraged by the coronavirus, because it's very unusual here, but we have had some sort of similar things. You know, the HIV virus wiped people out in massive quantities. I know lots of people could ignore that and put it somewhere else because it wasn't the type of people that they might know. But we do know something about how that feels and what that's about. And in other countries, you know, this wide experience of SARS, of Ebola, of, you know, polio eradication, all of those things. There's some interesting work about the 1918 influenza outbreak that I was trying to read back on the other day. So, you know, this idea is like we're starting from nothing, we've got to recreate all of these ideas, and we're going to be daring or not daring. You know, it's a lie, because there's lots of other really brilliant stuff out there to draw on already. We're not in an unreferenceable situation here. There's a lot to learn from those others. And then the other key thing that I did note was about the ethical question about what you do about narrators asking you questions. In one of the Ebola projects that I was reading about, there was some interesting stuff about how the people that were being interviewed were asking the interviewers questions because they had links with the Ministry of Health, and so things about whether they had infected their girlfriend who had then died, and whether they had that information, and how you share that information. You know, there's some really tricky stuff around that we would need to work out how you respond to. I mean, what do you do? I don't think the oral history textbooks have caught up with how you deal with that kind of thing yet. I mean, I suppose there's also, you know, there's that whole thing as well about why you call everything a disaster. And, you know, I know this is a disaster for lots of people. For lots of people, it probably isn't a disaster as well. There's probably some really interesting things happening in the hinterland of it all that will change people's lives in positive ways. And so that whole idea about you're always exposing the worst kind of trauma, and You are, but you aren't. You know, it's humanity. There's always different ways to interpret what disaster means somehow. Well, also, it's not going to be a thing that just comes, stops, finishes, it's over. It feels to me like there is some kind of new normal that we can be getting used to here, just in the same way as, you know, those other countries. How come South Korea is so much better at dealing with this? Well, because they've had some experience of these types of things, and there is a level of normality about this being a part of your life from now on with that you have to cope with. And I think, you know, as oral historians, it's going to be the same. I haven't really kind of thought through that whole thing about using the internet, using the online stuff sufficiently. I don't like doing it. I'm not one for the kind of social networking programs and things like that. So I'm bad with that stuff. I don't use it in my day-to-day life. I don't even particularly like FaceTiming people that I know very well. I find it very, very something that I don't like. I mean, there's an interesting thing that because we have to move everything online, that there's an assumption that that needs to be something visual and something, the video thing. I think I'd prefer to just stick with the sound thing and get really, really good at that and use the sound cues. But maybe that's just being really old fashioned. I don't know.
I don't know. I prefer this to phone interviewing. I mean, I've done phone interviewing, but I prefer this because I can see you.
Yes, but I can't really hear the sounds around where you are and where you live and things like that.
Are we making too much of, actually, we already have the practices and the ethics to do this. Do we have to have this conversation?
Yes, I think we do, because I think this, you know, it is quite extreme, the situation that we're facing at the moment. You know, it's testing times and it brings up loads of things that are rumbling along all the time in the background of oral historians, you know, like the whole thing about sort of doing things digitally, online. It's great in that way. We have to have those conversations. We have to explore the things that we knew we needed to talk about anyway. It forces different things onto the agenda, I think, in a good way.
Good.
It gets people like me to knock off the cobwebs in a way. I haven't for a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I think the work you've done is extremely valuable, actually, for this point in time.
Well, it's interesting because I was just in the middle of launching into this new project working with young people with HIV, who must be about the most protected group of people on the planet until now. But maybe this will change things. But, you know, obviously with that group, you know, immunological compromise is just a given, and you've just always got to be working that with that as a basic tenet that you would apply right across the board, and that changes everything about how you practice. And I think the coronavirus does the same thing in a way. You have to just assume that everybody's potentially compromised and at risk from you, and that changes the conversation.
Wendy finished by talking about following up interview partners who were interviewed before digitisation and online access. We often have to follow up older interviews in order to get new permissions.
Does the same thing in a way. You have to just assume that everybody's potentially compromised and at risk from you, and that changes the conversation.
Yeah, we're talking about earlier on, I was actually thinking about leprosy.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not sure if there's that same stigma around COVID-19. Although,
yeah,
when you step out to the shops, there certainly is.
Yeah.
You know, people are very wary of each other.
Absolutely, and I think all that stuff is really going to kick in now.
Yeah, so that's social distancing, and I think HIV, I think absolutely people I knew felt very socially isolated. You know, and it was like the idea you could catch HIV from, you know, there's all that stuff that went on, particularly around sort of hospitals, the stories that went around about catching HIV from people.
Yeah, I know, from toothbrushes and teeth cups and things like that. But then here we are facing it where you can catch COVID-19 from those things. And so it's it turns some of that, all that understanding on its head. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
But you see, the project that we were about to do with children that were born with HIV is just so interesting because, well, one, they've had it their whole lives, and because of they were perinatally infected, so there's whole issues around that source of infection and how that affected them in the different waves when different medications and things were available, to now, and what kind of life they've had. It's all absolutely fascinating. But for oral history, it's bloody amazing because it links up, it potentially makes intergenerational oral history. I'm wondering if I'm going to get anybody coming forward who is the child of someone that I interviewed 10 years ago, 20 years ago, wow, that we are going to be able to put those stories together.
Wendy's concerns are increasingly shared amongst oral historians and archivists. Her work of more than two decades ago continues to offer a way forward through follow-up reflective research that includes individual and group interviews. This has been a podcast for the Newcastle Oral History Unit and Collective. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact us via email, oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, and on Twitter, where we are @oralhistory_NCL.